And surely, if anybody was responsible for Perks resigning, it would be McNaughton.
I never recall any embarrassing situations arising.
Of course, as you say, it would be very much typical of Perks that he would make sure that no embarrassing situation would arise, you know.
Yeah.
At least I would think so. But I often wonder...
I used to travel around with Andy McNaughton quite a lot then. I had a great admiration for him, you know. He was certainly a great Canadian. I never quite forgave him for his attitude on the conscription business. I felt that he rather was trying to take it out on Ralston, you know, the fact that he came home from commanding the army. Ralston being his boss, his civil boss, and that there may have been a certain amount of spite in what he did or tried to do in leaving Ralston. I don't think Swetman covers that, but that's another story.
No, he...
I thought that he wrote a good biography, but it wasn't quite... It was too biased.
And
Andy's favorite.
Yeah, McNaughton was the white-haired boy. There's no getting around that.
It was too bad. I was going to write Swetman and tell him that I thought he might have questioned some of these things that Andy told him.
Yeah, because so many times in so many chapters, McNaughton... it seemed to be McNaughton was in step and all the rest of the army was out of step.
Exactly.
You know, and it's too bad, but the army was wrong. McNaughton was always eternally right.
Not only the Canadian army, but the British
Churchill and Brooke.
Yeah, Alan Brooke.
Yeah, Alan Brooke and several others.
Do you take cream and sugar?
Do you have it? Lovely.
Cream milk, I don't know about sugar. I never heard of any concertina between General McNaughton and General Perks during those days. I traveled with General McNaughton a great deal because he was chairman of the Canadian section of the Permanent Joint Board on Defense, and I was the Canadian Army representative, and both being Army people, we often sat together on our long trips around the continent and had long chats, but I never heard Andy say anything about George Perks that I can remember of, and I never remember George saying anything about Andy.
Well, there'd be quite a change in your relationship, of course, when Deep the Chief comes in, and more especially Perks comes in as minister.
Yes.
Can you remember anything about that? For example, the election, I think, surprised everybody in Canada.
Well, I was surprised, as not everybody else. And
I think it surprised Perks as well, I might add.
Ralph Campney was our minister.
Oh, Ralph Campney, that's right.
And we were always got on very well together. He was a lawyer, I'm a lawyer by profession. And of course, when the election terms come in, one could hardly believe that the government was defeated and Campney was defeated. And we assumed immediately that General Perks would be the defense minister, having been a defense critic in the shadow cabinet. And there was the usual briefings on a changeover from one minister to another minister. I mean, where the chief of the service arranges for the minister to be briefed on various phases and areas of the service concerned, what our army policy was on training and what training establishment we had and what equipment we had and what our equipment policy was and all that kind of thing, which is done over a period of time with different members of the staff at Army headquarters doing their particular part. This went on, it seems to me it was in July of 1958, wouldn't it be?
No, 57.
And then I was, I continued until my 3-year term was up, which was and at the end of 58.
Mm-hmm.
September 58.
Mm-hmm. Well, now, in that first year of the conservative takeover, if my memory serves right, there were a number of rather important decisions that had to be made. I think Fowkes was chairman of the Chiefs.
That's right.
Yeah. And it seems to me also that a decision had to be made almost right away with respect to NATO and atomic warheads. Am I not right there? For the Canadian forces in Europe. I know that within days...
I don't know if it was right away or not, but this atomic business was always on the fringe of everything.
Mm-hmm.
Whether it was the use of atomic weapons in Europe by our Air Force and short-range atomic weapons by the Army, or the stationing of atomic weapons in the American bases in Newfoundland, it was always seemed to be in a... Yeah, under discussion.
Mm-hmm.
And when I went back, you see, when I was vice chief, Fowkes was chief.
Mm-hmm.
And there was no chiefs of staff committee as such, with the chairman separate and apart. They used to take turns there.
Mm-hmm.
Well, then... after I left as vice chief to be GOC in Ontario, Fowkes, when this thing was reorganized and they had a chief of staff committee, and Fowkes was the chairman and mm-hmm. was overall sort of fellow.
Mm-hmm.
And the result of this was that when I went back to be CGS, I and the other chiefs never did have as close an association with the minister as we had before there wasn't a chairman of the chiefs of staff.
No, yes.
And sometimes this was one was inclined to be critical of this situation because you felt that maybe your case wasn't being properly presented when you wanted something in the way of equipment or
mm-hmm.
something else, some change in policy. But Charles Fowkes, as chairman of the chiefs of staff, wielded a great deal of influence. And was closer to the minister, both Campney and Burks, than the chiefs themselves were.
Mm-hmm.
Now, if this question were ever raised, we were always said, well, you can see the minister anytime you like.
Yeah.
You see? But I'm quite sure that the minister, both ministers that I served under, and the subsequent ministers too, were inclined to see the chairman of the chiefs of staff more, and in the case of Fowkes, with regard to army appointments, he might be listened to. And if there's any question in the minister's mind, he might say, well, Clark wants this or Graham wants this, but Fowkes thinks that something else is better. Well, then he may go along with Fowkes.
Mm-hmm.
But this is the sort of thing that you have to put up with when you're a chief of a service and you have a chairman of the chiefs of staff.
Yeah.
And I'm not saying it's bad, but... it certainly doesn't give the chief of the service the freedom of action that he had at one time, and maybe that's a good thing that he shouldn't have.
Mm-hmm. Of course, when he had direct access, it would be the minister who would have to act as referee more than he
that's
would
right.
if he had a chairman of the
that's right.
chief, and I suppose this was partly the whole idea.
That's right.
But I think I'm right in that when Proops... when Brooks took office, it would be, you know, within a day or so after the election, he flew to Ottawa, and then within a few days of flying to Ottawa, that he and Diefenbaker had to fly over to Europe to attend a NATO conference.
Right. That's right.
And it seems to me that there's one or two things that were hanging on, and one was this business of atomic weaponry, and I believe the other was
one of the big jobs was a CF-105, you know.
Yeah, that was there. But was it, didn't NORAD come up at that time?
Probably. It was a mutiny on the Griddle, too, what our representation would be.
Yeah. But there's a story around, and where the devil did I read it? That owing to the fact that decisions had to be made, and decisions with respect to more especially with respect to NORAD, that the Americans were willing to carry out this idea, the Liberal government had agreed in principle to the idea, and it was just put off until after the election when the Liberals were sure that they were going to come back. And then when Fouts briefed Perks, and telling him, you know, well, the Liberals had already agreed, it's a good idea in my mind. Fouts was one of Perks' old staff officers, so he would say, okay, if you think it's a good idea, and the Liberals were all for it, and it appears to be a good idea for me, then we will agree to it without prior consultation by the cabinet, by the conservative cabinets. In other words, that NORAD really was put through by Fouts rather than by Perks.
I wouldn't like to say anything about that, because I don't feel that at this time, after all these years, that I could recall exactly what did happen.
What changes did he bring in?
But there certainly were not any drastic changes in policy when the Diefenbaker government came in, except that a decision was finally made with regard to the CF-105.
Was that still in your time?
Oh, yes.
It was it?
Yeah. Come in.
Whoops. I'll have to
cut that off for you.
Yeah. Well, how would you describe that first year with him?
The conservative, I would describe it, from my recollection, as uneventful. Mm-hmm. With the exception of the decision on the 105. Mm-hmm. Which the Air Force in general were opposed to, and I think that the other two services felt that an enormous amount of money was being poured into it, and it was not a justifiable operation to continue it. And I remember when before the decision was finally announced, we had a rather unusual meeting with the Defense Committee of the Cabinet, with John Diefenbaker in the chair, and the chiefs were there, and we went over the thing together, and Diefenbaker wanted to know if there was anybody before he made the announcement that had any contrary opinions they wanted to hold to, and he was very good about it. It was a big decision to make.
No, I know, especially a big political decision.
Yeah. And decision made.
Would you say that if the Conservatives hadn't done it, that the Liberals would have?
Well, I wouldn't want to be quoted. I feel that it would have had to be canceled eventually. It was just, there wasn't a market for the aircraft.
Yeah.
And we couldn't possibly use enough aircraft to justify the production of these things at, what was it, $5 or $6 million a copy at that time, with all the increases at by the time they went into production, it passed by $8 or $10 million each.
Yeah.
And for the few that we would need for our Air Force, it was not. And the amount of money that had been put into it had never been really revealed.
Yeah.
But I'm sure that if it were added up, it would be $600-700 million.
Good Lord. Good heavens. Well, this is why I wonder, you know, if the Liberals wouldn't have. Evidently, they had been going.
I really honestly believe that the Liberals would have done it at the same time that the Tory did it.
Yeah. Yeah.
Had the liberals been returned to power, I really believe that would have happened.
Yeah. I think they would have had to, like it or not.
Yeah.
Because this was really getting into the time when weaponry is becoming so tremendously expensive that for a country such as Canada, although we're not poor, that we certainly couldn't compete with the new stuff coming out. And of course...
Well, too bad it wasn't done on a joint venture operation with the three countries, Britain, the United States, and Canada, together in some way. But, well, our scientific people were keen on getting on with it, and the Air Force, of course, were terribly keen about it.
Mm-hmm. Did you have anything to do with the Bobcat?
Yes, at the not at the start of it, but I remember the Bobcat very well. As a matter of fact, I gave it the name.
Did you?
They had this thing going when I went up to Ottawa, it had arrived at a stage where I felt, and some of my staff felt, that it was suitable, that we should quit. When I left the CDS chair, as far as I was concerned, the development on the Bobcat was finished. But again, the scientific people kept going at it and at it, and what it eventually came to, I don't know. But when we started, during my time, we had a good possibility of selling the Bobcat, as it then was, to the United States.
Yeah.
But there were the usual delays and developing and so on, and they developed one that they liked just as well, so that was that. And I think that they should cut the thing off and let it go.
Yeah.
But during my time, there was a development which turned out very well, although the Army hadn't used it. And when I went up there succeeding General Simmons, there was on the drawing board what we call an air truck, a very austere type of aircraft, short takeoff and landing.
Mm-hmm.
It would be used for forward supply, and it would be a larger version of the Beaver and the Otter by de Havilland. Well, when I went up, I think this was after General Perks came in, it may have been before, after a great deal of difficulty, we got the Cabinet and the Treasury Board to agree to carrying on with the cost of producing this by de Havilland, under an agreement by which de Havilland would repay the government or whatever they had contributed as the aircraft were sold, if they were sold to other countries. And we called it the Buffalo. And of course, the Buffalo has gone on, and many hundreds were turned out, were sold to Australia and many of the developing countries, India, and de Havilland have done very well out of it, and the government have got all their money back. But in the meantime, the concept of the armed forces has changed, and I think they're using helicopters now. Instead of, because the helicopter development went on in commercial concern, not under government contract, and the helicopters now used instead of the Buffalo. But that was a very good and useful operation. But the Bobcat was, I was astounded when I read about all the money that had been spent after I left.
Oh, I know, it just pours out. Does the nickname Tricky Dicky mean anything to you? It doesn't.
Velvet Glove does.
Velvet Glove. Now,
that was an air-to-air missile, I think it was, that the Defense Research people worked at and spent $24, $25 million on.
Yeah.
And it was... but Tricky Dicky, I don't know anything.
This chap may not have been there when you left. He may have come in later. But it was Perks, what would you call him? Personal assistant, I think. His name is Roberts.
Oh, I remember Dick Roberts.
Yeah, Richard Roberts, I think his name was.
That's right. Dick Roberts.
Yeah. And some people have said that he had this terminology, that this is one of the, this was one of Perks's errors, or at least a poor appointment on Perks' place, because this fellow used to evidently stroke many people the wrong way or something.
I never heard that. I don't know Dick Roberts.
Yeah.
He's still in External Affairs.
Yeah. Yeah. That's right. That's right. Yeah. Yeah.
And I never had that experience with him.
Mm-hmm. I didn't know. And
he was a very enthusiastic young gentleman.
Yeah.
Ambitious, perhaps, but I never heard that expression.
Yeah. Yeah. Was there anything during the time when he was in opposition, Perks periodically would speak in favor of some degree of integration of the chaplain corps, dental corps, medical corps.
Oh, yeah.
Again, during the year that you were there as chief.
We integrated the chaplain service, I think, when I was there, or the medical service, or both.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And we were, most of us were in favor of a very high degree of integration.
Mm-hmm.
I myself pressed very hard for an integrated signal corps.
Mm-hmm.
But it was integration was difficult. I think, of course, that there should have been more integration and less amalgamation than
yeah.
there has been.
Yeah.
But
some people say that it couldn't have been accomplished the way Perks was trying to do it, that the only way to do it was to sort of wield a big and bloody axe and just say that there will be unification and integration.
No, I don't agree with that at all.
No.
I think that integration is quite possible. I think you could have an integrated supply service.
Mm-hmm.
I think you could have an integrated, always had an integrated dental service,
mm-hmm.
even in the war.
Yeah.
We integrated the medical corps, worked fine, integrated chaplain corps. And I don't think integration always yielded the economies that one had expected.
Mm-hmm.
That was the fault, our
yeah.
fault, not the fault of the policy yeah. of integration.
Yeah. Yeah. Did you ever have, and I rather doubt this, but would you ever have anything to do personally with Diefenbaker, aside from this time that you mentioned?
I had a great deal to do with him, yes, during the Queen's visit in 59. He, either on the recommendation of General Perks or Mr. Massey, the Governor General, appointed me coordinator of the arrangements for the tour in 59 when the Queen came over.
Oh, I see.
And I had my experience was very, very happy with Mr. Diefenbaker, except that he was sometimes difficult to get a decision from.
Mm-hmm.
But they had a cabinet committee. George Heath was the chairman of the cabinet committee, mm-hmm. made up of about six ministers from across Canada.
Mm-hmm.
And I was the coordinator, and I reported to the prime minister, if he wasn't there, to the chairman of the cabinet committee. And I kept them briefed on what was developing. It was a very complicated operation,
mm-hmm.
because the Queen was here for 43 days, I think. And but Mr. Diefenbaker gave me good support.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, he's a great royalist himself.
Yeah. Yeah.
And I had a lot to do with him then,
mm-hmm.
both in the preparation of the tour and during the tour. For instance, he went to Chicago. I traveled with the Queen as Canadian secretary, and he went down, he and Mr. Diefenbaker in the yacht with us to Chicago, and he was with her on some other occasions. And I would like to old John.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I've only met him once, actually. I've one sees him on TV and all that sort of thing, but I gather that a great many people would say also that one of his problems was this reaching a decision.
Yeah.
And that I also know that there was that in time there developed within the cabinet a split between Perks and Green. Perks being the hawk and Green's being the dove, shall
probably
we say.
Yeah.
I mean, Perks' job called for him to be a hawk. You know, this was it. And this, of course, right in the center, was this the problem of the atomic warhead. Should we have it or should we not?
Yeah. Well, Howard Green, who was a classic, we were both in the same law office in Toronto in 1920 and 1921, so I know him very well.
Oh, yeah.
And he certainly is a dove when it comes to...
Yeah.
Yeah.
But this wouldn't have caused you any trouble, I suppose.
No.
In 58, the time that you were there.
No.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, that's good. That's good.
Well, that's an awful lot I've been talking about. Did you get any wheat out of the chaff?
I shall indeed. I shall indeed. And what I'll do, and what I've done with all the people that I've interviewed, I'll get our interview typed out, and I'll send you a copy. Incidentally, what is your address in Ottawa?
I'm living in Oakville.
Oh, in Oakville.
Near Toronto, yeah. You wouldn't do that verbatim, would you?
Oh, yeah.
Do you really?
Oh, yeah. It will be typed verbatim, and then I send it to you. And if there's anything in the interview where you don't want to be quoted, just put a red line or some sort of a mark in the margin and say, you know, I can refer to it, but not necessarily where I got the information or anything of that nature.